Welcome to the London Walks podcast. This episode, Thirsty London Part 2.
Okay, so we're halfway down Fleet Street now, and we're at the
Tipperary.
It wasn't such a long way, after all, to the Tipperary. Here it is, halfway down Fleet Street. It's the oldest Irish pub in London. London's so full of Irish pubs, and, yeah, you know, most of them are about as Irish as Colonel Gaddafi.
Is there the Toucan? The Toucan is a famous one.
The Toucan over in Soho does Prime Guinness.
Okay,
It's always very busy on St. Patrick's Night. Busy most nights of the week.
What was famous about this one? It was the first one
in about 1700. The Mooney Company, brewing company from Ireland, set up their pub here on the site of the old Boar's Head Tavern.
Oh, okay.
The first Irish pub, first bona fide Irish pub.
And why did they change the name to the Tipperary? What?
That's much more recent. It's 1918, the end of the First World War. The print workers, those who were lucky enough to come back from the First World War. This was their pub. You've sort of got the class system in microcosm in Fleet Street, because the editors and so forth would have lunched very well at the top of the road at El Vino's, which is still going strong. And the print workers, the chapel, as they were nicknamed, would have come to another place. So it's a sort of it's the blue collar workers and the white collar workers.
So this is the
home
of the tabloid press then, really, Fleet Street, was it? Was that kind of?
It was. It's one of the things that it's famous for, certainly. The tourist board nickname being the Street of Ink, which I don't think the Street of Drink would perhaps be more appropriate given journalists' lunchtime habits. Well documented.
A lot of gossip.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of pubs. The original Irish pub, the Tipperary here, where they sold the first bottled Guinness as well in England.
And the fittings from it are actually from the original pub, aren't they?
Which I think it makes it a refreshing Irish pub, because it doesn't have, like the many an Irish theme pub with shillelaghs and whatnot hanging from the ceiling. Yeah. This actually has, as you say, original fittings.
Do you prefer pale one, yeah? Pale or dark?
I'll have a pale one, so try pale.
The Irish contribution to English letters is an important one. There's the great quote from Kenneth Tynan, the old theatre critic, who said, writing of Brendan Behan, no stranger to a pub himself, the Irish writer, that the English hoard words like misers, the Irish spend them like sailors on leave. In the best tradition of news of the world journalism, I, at this point, am going to make my excuses and leave Fleet Street. I'm heading over towards Clerkenwell to find London's finest pub. Meanwhile, Andy is popping back over to the Cheshire Cheese to complete his ruminations on the history of the pub.
Inns, very different to alehouses. They provide food, accommodation, stay overnight there. They were stopping off points for travellers, pilgrims, monks, soldiers. And they're going to eventually lead to the coaching inns, the stage coaches. And you still stop off there. The wealthier passengers who could afford to travel inside the coach were entertained in the saloon bar, of course. So we got that from. And the outsiders hang off or sat on the outside of the coach would be entertained in the public bar. Eventually, of course, it's going to turn into railway taverns. I think it was Brunel, apparently, who invented the idea of the English circular bar. No bar on the trains. The quickest way to get served before getting back on be a circular bar, rather than the kind of orderly queue. But it's the taverns, actually, amongst all them, which represent the closest to the spirit of today's pubs. Taverns were introduced by the Romans. Soldiers who could stop off, enjoy a glass of vino, buy a sign, and have some reference to hanging grapes or vines. The Latin for taberna means shop. And in those days, that meant a shop which usually sold wine. Taberna corrupted over the years to tavern. Now, I think taverns, they survived in kind of small but little profitable niches. They would serve nobles, clergymen, or anybody else who'd been abroad and become accustomed to kind of fancy foreign wine drinking ways. But eventually they began to sell beer as well as wine. There was kind of less of an air of necessity about taverns. They existed in slightly more prosperous towns. They're more aloof than alehouse. But without the formality of a gentleman's club, that's a great way of describing it. These are places where those with the responsibility could kick back and let off steam. So I mean professionals, lawyers, members of parliament, but also the home of wits and scoundrels, thinkers, perhaps poets and playwrights, maybe even the dreaded actors. Now, over the years, taverns, of course, are going to become your kind of coffee house. And the coaching houses are going to be replaced by railway taverns, which are eventually going to virtually disappear off altogether. And the ale house, well, no longer a small cottage industry in a kind of community rural backwater. Although that's beginning to come back, isn't it? That idea for that kind of microbreweries. But over the years, they've really all declined and become indistinguishable. We have the big commercial pubs today mostly, but their legacy is their legacy, which makes up the modern day pub. So I would say it's the community aspect of the alehouse, the architecture and sense of national heritage, that is the coaching inns, and the great spirit of the tavern. So put them all together, you've got your modern day British pub.
Pub of the month, this month, is the Three Kings of Clerkenwell. It's the pub of the month every month, in my opinion. Within a week of landing in London, more than 20 years ago, I ended up in Clerkenwell. And within a week of ending up in Clerkenwell, I had fallen inexorably in love with London. The Three Kings was one of the reasons. If there is such a thing as a perfect pub, the Kings comes damn near close. Even when empty, sparsely populated of an early week evening, with the fire on the go, it has the womish, conspiratorial feel of the perfect place for a stolen, illicit night out. Of a Friday night, it rocks. In summer, punters spill out onto the pavement, and Clerkenwell Close fairly buzzies, as the trio of kings on the swinging pub sign, that's Henry VIII, King Kong, and, of course, Elvis Presley, look down on the fun. Fine lunches too, great beer on tap, and a superb vinyl jukebox. When I first discovered this place, as I say, more than 20 years ago now, it was a traditional pub with one or two eccentric touches. Over the years, the eccentricity has slowly taken over, like lush ivy on an already lovely old building. These things take time. Character cannot be achieved with that dreadful 21st century thing, the makeover. Great things have come to those of us who have waited at the Kings, and things were pretty bloody good to start with, if you ask me. We'll quote Kenneth Tynan again. We quoted him earlier on in this podcast. He once said of the play Look Back in Anger, "I could not love anyone who did not wish to see this play." I feel the same way about the Three Kings of Clerkenwell. Pub of the month, pub of the year, every year. The Three Kings in Clerkenwell Close. Heading now towards the end of Steve's Hidden Pubs of Old London Town Walk, and we are in the alleyways off and around Fleet Street, Sweeney Todd's Fleet Street.
We're in Bride Lane, and we're outside two wonderful pubs, actually. One's called the Crown and Sugarloaf, and the other one's called the Punch, which are originally the same pub. They've been split up.
Now, this is the case. It's two pubs for the price of one. Famously, over in the West End, there's the Ship and Chevelle at the Embankment, which is a pub split into two pieces. But this is two pubs from one, is that right?
Two gin palaces. So the Crown and Sugarloaf is owned by Samuel Smith's, and then next to it, I'm not sure what it was split up exactly, but it was the Punch Tavern next to it, which is owned by, it's the flagship for Punch Taverns, actually.
Okay, famous business.
Yeah. And, two gin palaces, and
now the gin palaces are very ornate inside the glasswork, the etched mirror and glasswork inside. I've heard that this is a twofold purpose. It is said from the late 19th century, where the ornate glass
one story goes, is to make the interior of the pub a little more palatable to the feminine sensibility and the upper classes. Very different time, of course. The practical purpose of the glass and the mirrors was a security thing, so the barman, the landlord, could keep an eye on street urchins coming in to dip into your pocket.
Right.
Very ornate.
I've heard the kind of Punch was where I edited a Punch magazine. When did that stop? 25 years ago or something now? But it was a kind of satirical monthly...
Well, yes, we're down to one satirical magazine, Private Eye. It's all we've got left. The Punch, 20 years ago maybe,
So editors from the Punch used to drink in the Crown and Sugarloaf, and you had a Punch and Judy show around the corner as well. And then it was split up. I think there is a kind of... I think perhaps even a legal dispute going on between the two of them, you know, right now. But the Crown and Sugarloaf, I know the Crown.
Well, the Crown is the king,
is
surely.
The king. We've got the Bridewell Palace down the bottom of the road, and the Sugarloaf, a regiment of his of Henry VIII's soldiers wore a helmet like a loaf of sugar. If you went to a grocer's in those days, the sign for a grocer's was a cornet, like a loaf of sugar. That was the sign for a grocer's. So put it together, the Crown and Sugarloaf, that's where the name comes from. But it was split up, the Punch and the Crown and Sugarloaf, and there's a bit of a dispute going on right now. And also, next door, we've got this new thing, which is a kind of City of London distillery and gin bar next door.
Okay, so exclusively for gin?
Exclusively for gin, yeah. Hundreds of different gins there. That's the first one for 250 years or so.
William Hogarth would have a thing or two to say about this, yes, obviously. Absolutely. Gin being wicked and evil, beer being honest and good for you.
You drink ale in the morning to give a truculence and euphoria for the rest of the day, ale in the afternoon to get rid of those wasted tissues, and ale in the evening to give you a healthy, heavy, snoring repose.
It's good advice, I think. I think we should catch up with Steve now and go and get truculent and euphoric.
Absolutely.
The London Walks podcast was compiled, produced and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding. For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.